You're listening to International Women's Day 2019 on 3CR Community Radio.
This week marks the 10th anniversary of the National Apology to the Stolen Generation. However, 10 years on, how much has changed? In 2017, an estimated 17,664 Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children were living in out-of-home care. Grandmothers Against Removals is a community group that started in 2014 by First Nations community members that were directly affected by child removals. To talk to us about this issue from Grandmothers Against Removals, we are joined by Christine Nyungware Palmer. Christine has a long history of working in Aboriginal welfare organisations and has provided evidence to the Royal Commission into Protection and Detention of Children in Northern Territory. Christine will talk about her work with Grandmothers Against Removals and about Reconciliation Week. Welcome, Christine.
Good morning, and thank you for this opportunity. Firstly, I'd like to acknowledge the Aboriginal people of the Wiradjuri mob and all Aboriginal grandmothers and peoples who's listening out there this morning. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. Thank you, Christine. So Grandmothers Against Removals has had a busy week this week meeting with government. What demands or what has been happening for Grandmothers Against Removals this week?
Well, it was very interesting. We met with our Aboriginal ministers and they really couldn't commit to anything. We then went and met with Indigenous Minister Scullion, and he has given us agreed to meet all delegations, you know, in our own communities. And he has also will make arrangements for him and Northern Territory Minister Dale Wakefield to meet with us with our demands in Alice Springs.
That's great. And what are some of the demands of the group?
Of the group?
Of Grandmothers Against Removals.
Yeah. We said that Australian government must be made accountable and for all the damage they have done. And we, as Aboriginal people, need to step up now and say no more. Their trust has been broken over and over again, and they must allow us to work together to keep our kids safe at home. Our law, culture and kinship system must be respected and supported. But some of the demands, well, we as First Nations grandmother, we demanded no adoption of our children, and it was appalling to hear that four of our Aboriginal children already have been adopted, and that is far too many. We need the government to end the institutionalisation of our children in all forms, like no more removals, no more imprisonment. Restore all removed and imprisoned children to their families. Give First Nations communities control of our welfare so we can keep families together through culturally appropriate. We need therapeutic services to support healing, and this will end in the pipeline from the appropriate trauma-informed, you know. Child protection system through to juvenile justice and the adult criminal justice system. Overhaul of the child protection, juvenile justice and all related systems that target our families and violate the rights of children every day, properly address the faults, failures and criminal activity that plagues these systems. And this means holding government, non-government and individual perpetrators accountable for any physical, psychological and sexual abuse of children in care, and sometimes resulting in death. Overhauling the processes used to assess family members as carers and make decisions about family contact to ensure genuine compliance with the Aboriginal Child Placement Principle. These decisions must be determined by the families and communities that know how to keep their children safe and cared for. So we presented these demands to the Australian government, knowing that we are the only ones who can make sure our children are safe. And our people have run our own programs for our communities that have succeeded for generations. We have shown the First Nations community control works We will keep fighting for our children and build up to a national gathering on the 11th anniversary of apology to the stolen generation on 13th of February 2019. So in saying all that, we did meet with our Northern Territory Families Minister, and we demanded, before we came down, how many children in care, how many children in detention, how many of those children are on the remand, how many residential care houses, how many children in house, how many in kinship care, how many children have been taken into state. And that was appalling to hear too. Our children are still taken into, you know, moving with a non-Indigenous family into other states. And we also need to know the ratio of staff to children. I was at a rally one day in Central Australia, and I heard somebody say that we have a real toxic state. And I like that line and that word, because we do have a toxic state. And all the non-Indigenous people, no matter what sector they work in, within the government, non-government, they come with this mentality that they can treat us any way they can. And we're tired of all that. We need to take control. We have, and what you're asking is that we need to sit down with somebody in COAC to have an honest conversation, a true conversation as human beings, because our human rights has been played with so many times, and we need to start sitting down with honest people, you know?
Yeah. And speaking of children, Christine, how has Grandmothers Against Removals been working in the space of youth imprisonment?
Well, we have to keep an eye on what's happening then.
Yeah.
I went out there the other day in Alice Springs, the juvenile detention there. It's like there's a limited bed there for those youth. Well, it's busting at the seam. We don't know where those kids are sleeping, you know, on mattresses, on floor or whatever. So that's one of the main things that we're going to be looking at. We want to find out who's in there. We want to check to see if they got OCA card that everyone has to have when they're working with children. Because in the past we've had, you know, people on working holiday, and this is true. You know, people go on working holidays. Their aunties or uncles may be in senior positions, so they say, well, come up here, I'll give you a job. So we need to keep a really tight rein on who's being employed as well. It's only a little space in where the juvenile detention is. They've kind of gave a quarter or corner of that little block. They've put in two demountables for the girls. We're going back to, in full force, to go and with the minister to have a look at that little yard with so many of our mob in there, of our kids are in there. And those kids haven't even been, they're only on remand. They haven't been committed or charged with anything. And instead of them sitting there, you know, and getting mistreated and abused, well, they could be back with a kinship, you know, family members, or back with family.
Mm. And because there's been so much, well, I mean, this has been an issue for many, many decades now. But there's been particular controversy in the last couple of weeks around really negative comments being made about the stolen generation and a new stolen generation, some really horrible stuff that's come out in the media. And it's why it's so important at the moment, particularly in Reconciliation Week, to start talking about, or to continue talking about, that young people, young Aboriginal people, are still being removed from their homes, even though people think the stolen generation is over.
Well, that's what I thought, you know. It really, I had to really listen to the GMAs, and I didn't you know, realise I'm behind the eight ball. You know, I did not realise that our children were taken from their families and put into non-Indigenous families. And I heard with our meeting with our Northern Territory Family Minister, she was saying that the non-Indigenous carers are making decisions like, well, I don't think they should go back to their family, so I'm going to keep them. Now, who gives them the right to keep our kids? So we need to get on top of that statement, and that's something that we're going to be doing in Alice Springs. We're going to be assessing many services in Alice Springs, and I want to start around the courthouse where it's all messy, very messy, just around the courthouse, where there's a lot of new youth services and youth workers are there, and they're popping up, you know, with new names that I'm not familiar with. And they're all there running around with this child, not talking to family, grandmothers that's in the courthouse, or not even using an interpreter to explain what's happening. So there's a lot of stuff that we need to go back and assess what's happening with our children. And then we will start jotting down all the stuff that we have gathered, because nobody's doing it.
And so Grandmothers Against Removals, is a lot of their work based in Alice Springs? Because it seems that you move around the country a bit, because this week you're in Canberra, but is it mainly in Alice?
Well, it will be in Alice, but some of the grandmothers around Tennant Creek and remote communities have seen us on TV, they've heard our interviews, and now they want to come on board. So we will be looking forward and having and inviting all grandmothers around the central region to a meeting to explain what we need to do and what has been talked about up to now. Aboriginal people, no matter, you know, across the nation, we have a beautiful kinship system, and that is not recognised through the government or any government agency. We need to embed our children into with culture, with survival skills. And only we can do that. We can take them back to country, fill the children with the cultural knowledge, show them how to survive in the bush, finding water in dry creek beds, by digging soaking, looking at what seasonal bush food's around and bush medicine, and for them to identify tribal boundaries, tribal groups, and mainly to express themselves, for them to relax on country, allowing country to fill them. And we need for them to start respecting themselves by sitting quietly and respect themselves, respect to everyone around them, and respect to country. Those things government can't do. Or any agencies.
Yeah.
We as grandmothers, there are certain trees and animals and how to break up and what we can use by cooking, you know, our native animals. You've got to learn how to cut it up. You don't just grab it and disrespect an animal. These are the things that we can do as grandmothers. And our old people, you know, older, we got to get them up and running, because they've got a very important role as well. And to continue watching over us and making sure we're doing the right thing.
And this is important also not just for young people but for all Aboriginal people and also non-Aboriginal Australia as well, to recognise that there's really great healing to be done when First Nations people heal.
And that's right. And we can only do that on country. And we've got to strip down the fear that a lot of people have. Our Aboriginal people have to walk around with this fear, and anybody with a white skin thinking they're boss, you know, that where anybody can come along and say something to any of our old people or young people and demand things, and because of the fear of the consequences, we have to break that down. We have to allow them to start looking at they have human rights as well.
Christine, thank you so much for talking with us today. I wanted, just before we head off, I wanted to allow you to mention how people can get involved. So you said that there's going to be a meeting for all the people living in Central Australia coming up soon. But if people are really interested in getting involved, and especially grandmother, First Nations grandmothers all around Australia, how can they get in touch with you?
Well, we have a Facebook page, but I would encourage all the grandmothers around the nation to stay strong, black and deadly, and to start working within their own community and start assessing what government and non-government organisations are not doing for our children. We will be back in Canberra in 6 months' time, and we want to fill the Aboriginal Embassy and go up to in full force with all grandmothers all from all nations and tribal groups in Australia. We've got a lot of work to do, and government has to listen, to listen to us, because we are the answers to our problems.
Well, good luck. I think that's really exciting. I think that the work Grandmothers Against Removals are doing is amazing. So that Facebook group is, if you just search for at gmar.grandmothersagainstremovals, it comes up. I had a look last night, so you'll find it pretty easy. Thank you so much, Christine, for talking with us this morning about what Grandmothers Against Removals are doing, and also about what is happening currently for young Aboriginal people in this country.
And one of the, before you go, I spoke to Minister Scullion in regards to the ex-Don Dale detainees, especially up in Darwin.
Yeah.
I visited up there, and I told him that the prison officers over there is mistreating and abusing, and that has to stop. So stated that he will get in touch with our Chief Minister up in the Northern Territory, Michael Gunner, and have a word with him. And I will make sure, follow that up and see what the outcome of that conversation would look like. Because those little fellows, you know, ex-Don Dale detainees in there, they've never had any debriefing after the Four Corners report. They did not respect them as well, and they needed healing. They still need healing. That's something that the grandmothers and we'll get the top-end grandmothers to start looking at what they can do for those young fellows as well. Thank you very much.
Christine Nyungware Palmer.
You're listening to International Women's Day on 3CR 2019.
And now we're actually going to jump straight into a chat with Melissa Lukashenko, who is an multi-award-winning guru writer. Her novel Mullumbimby was awarded the Deloitte Queensland Literary Award for Fiction and won the Victorian Premier's Prize for Indigenous Writing, and was longlisted for both the Stella Prize and Miles Franklin Awards, as well as the Dublin IMPAC Literary Prize in 2015. Melissa was awarded the 2016 Cal Fellowship to work on her new novel Too Much Lip, which was released in August 2018. And that is exactly what we're going to be talking about this morning. Good morning, Melissa.
Jingiwala from Meanj in Brisbane.
Thank you so much for making time to chat with us this morning.
No worries.
So I was wondering, we're essentially this morning we're going to be chatting about, we're going to start at least by chatting about your new book, Too Much Lip, which I'm halfway through and can't put down. But I was wondering, could you just give listeners a bit of an overview of the book to begin?
Yeah, well, the book is it's set in the Aboriginal underclass in country New South Wales, and I wrote it because my last book, Mullumbimby, was a hit. And I sort of wanted to turn my attention in this book to Aboriginal lives of people that are really struggling.
And in 2015, I interviewed Alice Walker for the Sydney Writers' Festival. And to do that, I read her first book, which is an intergenerational story similar to The Colour Purple, but different. And it looked at three generations of how racism and poverty had affected the black American sharecropping family. And I thought, I want to do an intergenerational story too, to look at what happens in a family that begins with extreme violence and the different trajectories that the siblings take in response to that in a family. And so that's how Too Much Lip came about. And I also wanted to write a high-energy book as a response to the kind of heaviness and depression that, you know, we can sometimes slip into when we're faced with, you know, structural racism and sexism and homophobia. And I wanted to say, well, no, fuck that. Let's actually see what happens when we get angry at the right people for the right reasons and take action.
Mm. Yeah, and on that note of calling it like a high energy book, it's, I mean, you know, while, yeah, as you say, in some parts it's incredibly heavy, it's also profoundly funny.
I knew it had to be funny. I put myself the challenge because humour is actually the most difficult thing to write. Mm. And so I said to myself, okay, look at this intergenerational story, but make it really funny and make it a high energy adventure at the same time.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And you also seem, you know, like in the beginning, you very much like draw from different genres as well, you know, almost like spoofing Western type scenarios.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it sort of goes all over the place.
Well, someone once said there's only two stories, and that is someone leaves town or someone arrives in town. And so I had that in my mind when Kerry, the main character, rides into the little country town that she's from on a stolen Harley.
Mm.
To attend her grandfather's passing. And yes, so it's like, yeah, Kerry arrives in town and all bets are off kind of thing.
Yeah. And could you talk a bit more about Kerry or more broadly, I guess, yeah, your inspiration in creating characters like Kerry?
I think with Kerry, look, one of the questions I was asking myself was how might my life have gone if I never went to uni, if I'd stayed in Logan City? That was one question. And then another question was, how do I write a character that gives, you know, great intelligence and wit and strength as well as vulnerability to an underclass woman, which are qualities that I see, you know, in my work at Sisters Inside every week. These women that just, you know, they have the most unbelievable obstacles in their lives that would make, you know, most Australians just fall down dead on the spot. And yet they keep going, and they keep going with good humour and often with grace as well. So it's like, yeah, Kerry is an amalgam of lots of women I've known, white women as well as black women, but she's a bit of wish fulfilment there, you know, because who wouldn't like to ride back into their hometown on a stolen Harley and
set boyfriends
off all over the place?
She's such a spunk.
And it's like, yeah, fight back. You know, the first section of the book, which is the two halves, the first section's called Less is Less. And then the second part, which you might not have gotten to, is called If You Don't Fight, You Lose.
Mm.
So it's an adventure story, but it's about fighting back, striking back.
Yeah. Actually, maybe I'll get to that in a moment. But first of all, you mentioned your work with Sisters Inside, of which I believe you were a founding member. Could you talk a bit more about the work you do with Sisters Inside?
Yeah, well, Sisters Inside started in the late 80s inside Bogger Road, with Debbie Kilroy being the driving force the whole way through. And then in the very early 90s, a group of outside women, of which I was one, met in West End here, and under Debbie's kind of leadership, we decided that an external organisation was going to happen to advocate for, you know, prison abolition or decarceration, and also act as a support service to women who were stuck in the system. And I think it's been 25 years now, and the organisation's going strong, and we've got a conference coming up in November, and Angela Davis will be coming to our conference, same as she does most years. Yeah, and so we provide a culturally safe space for women with lived prison experience, and a lot of our a lot of the women we work with are Murray women and Islander women. Actually, we've just opened a North Queensland branch in the last 12 months. Mm. And trying to make some inroads into the lack of support and services for women up in the North Queensland there, which is sorely needed.
Mm. And do you feel like your work with Sisters Inside impacts or influences your writing?
It does. I come and go from Sisters. At different points I'll be working there, and at other points I won't be actively involved. But, yeah, it does. And, I've got two brothers that have spent many years in the system themselves, and so that feeds in. I've got extended family that are in and out of jail and in and out of the foster care system, the different things that I look at in the book. Mm. So it's not just Sisters, it's my own extended family as well, and just the community generally.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm trying to shine a light on those experiences. Whereas in Mullumbimby, I was looking at a woman who was a Koori woman that was more in the working class and wasn't as impoverished and had a different set of challenges.
Mm. And yeah, and I guess, and it seems like you, as you say, those influences find their way into your writing in many different ways, and in Too Much Lip as well. For the mayor, the character of the mayor intends to build a private prison on the riverbend, where some of the main characters' ancestors are buried. Could you, just before we spoke about with Charandev, our previous guest, we spoke about the private Serco-run women's prison in Grafton.
Yes.
Do you have any views on that you'd like to share with listeners this morning?
I didn't know that there was a private prison proposed for Grafton when I plotted this novel out nearly 3 years ago now. And so, yeah, it's... you don't have to be a genius to see the trend towards monetizing poverty and monetizing misery through constructing more and more private prisons and for the benefit of corporations at the expense of our families and communities. But as I was writing Too Much Lip, the different aspects of the plot became clear to me that I was writing stuff a lot closer to home than I'd realised. So I'd plotted a story, with the family dramas, and it turned out that much more of those family dramas were present in my own family than I realised, and also the prison, the proposal for a private prison for profit on Bundjalung land, was true at the same time, and I didn't know any of that. So, it's funny how you can write stuff thinking it's fiction and it turns out to be fact.
Yeah, absolutely. And in a separate interview at one point, you've described Too Much Lip as by far the hardest book that you've ever written. If you feel comfortable, obviously, but why is that?
It's the subject matter, because even though it's a funny book and it's an adventure story, I do go to some really dark places in it. And I did that deliberately. I thought, if Alice Walker can do it in my black American family, then I kind of have a responsibility as an Aboriginal writer and a feminist to go there as well and to kind of seize the nettle. But it was a very difficult decision to write about family violence in the way that I did. And I questioned myself. It took 2 years to write the book. And I questioned myself every single week I was writing. There was quite a few sleepless nights. But I've had a really, really positive response from my Aboriginal readers. And, one Aboriginal feminist who I won't name told me that she sobbed on a plane reading this book. And, I can't really get much better feedback than that from my black readers. So I'm glad I took that risk.
Mm. And earlier when we were chatting, you mentioned something about you know, writing as a form of fighting back, or fiction as a form of fighting back. What can you unpack that a bit for us, just as we're wrapping up?
I guess if you can't imagine the change that you want to see, it's almost impossible to create it. And for lots of years, I've had a character in the back of my mind, which is the protagonist in The Bone People by the Maori author Kerry Hume. And her strength and her oddness and her determination to do the right thing by the child in that novel has sort of underpinned a lot of my thinking and a lot of my writing, even when I haven't been quite conscious of it. It's been there unconsciously. And so it's about creating characters and creating archetypes and heroes, I suppose, for my readers, to say that, you know, the temptation to sit around and be depressed and feel hopeless is always there, and that's what the system wants, you know. That's what racists want. That's what capitalists want. They want us to sit around and feel like it's hopeless, but it's not. And so I wanted to create characters that embodied that spirit of fighting back and of still retaining some humour and, you know, some sense of a good life being possible.
Hmm. Yeah, wow. And unfortunately we're running out of time this morning, but to finish up, could you just let listeners know where can they grab a copy of this book, and also how can they find out more about the Sisters Inside conference?
Oh, okay. You can go to the Sisters Inside website. If you've been to jail yourself as a woman or a girl, then it's free. And if not, the registration details are at sistersinside.com.au, I think it is. And as far as the book goes, go to your local library and ask for Too Much Lip. And I think it's available as an e-book as well, or from any good bookshop in Nam.
Yeah, wonderful. Thanks so much for joining us this morning, Melissa.
Okay, bye.
Bye. Just then, we had a really amazing chat with Melissa Lukashenko, the award-winning author of Too Much Lip.